From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. After 2 weeks of daily political convention coverage, your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, has the week off. But he's left us with a number of compelling interviews recorded during those weeks that time limitations didn't let us include in the previous couple of shows. And so, this week, you'll hear politicians and activists, faith leaders, and others whom Welton and Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline met while covering the conventions. We'll also rewind back to August of 2008, when the Democratic Party had just nominated a young senator named Barack Obama as its candidate for the White House. Welton's conversation from that time with the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, who at the time was serving as the first woman director of the Department of Religion at the Chautauqua Institution, underscores how much has changed during the intervening 8 years, but also how much has remained the same. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Religious liberty is an issue that has been shamefully hijacked to shield bias and discrimination across the country. A particular area of concern has been the federal law titled the First Amendment Defense Act, which claims to protect religious conscience while actually enshrining disapproval of marriage equality and other LGBT rights in a broad swath of public life. Late last month, the true intentions of the legislation were revealed when supporters pulled out, right after a Republican co-author of the bill added language protecting deeply held beliefs supportive of same-sex families. Yes, once again, conservative support for something described as defending freedoms deflated the moment the usefulness of this legislation as a weapon of attack against LGBT rights was diminished. Religious liberty in the arena of sexual minorities came up in a number of conversations at this year's DNC. Here's Welton Gaddy in conversation with longtime Democratic Congressman Jerry Nadler of New York, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, and Kate Kite, who attended the convention representing LPAC as the superhero character Wonder Queer.
Congressman Nadler, tell us where we are on religious freedom and what needs to be done during this election season on that subject.
Well, this is one of the recurring cycles in American history of know-nothingism, nativism. It's been every couple of generations, I suppose, it comes out. You know, the anti-Catholic know-nothing party of the 1850s, the Pope was going to invade. Even in the 1870s, you look at Thomas Nast's cartoons about Tammany Hall, they're all, you know, alligators or crocodiles wearing bishop's mitres, the Catholics are going to take over. And then the anti-Chinese exclusions, and then the terrible discrimination against Jews and Italians and Greeks and Eastern Europeans in the 1920s. We passed a terrible immigration law in 1924, which excluded people on the basis of national origin. And the Almanac of American Politics, description of my district, says that had a nativist, anti-Semitic, racist Congress not passed that law, maybe 2 million of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust would have been in the United States instead. And we continue this with the Japanese internments, and well, that's part of our civil liberties backlash every time there's a war or something. But it's exclusive. I don't know. We didn't do that to the Germans and Italians here. We just did it to the Japanese, although we were at war with all three of them. This is in the same tradition of nativist hatred, which comes up every so often. And unfortunately, Mr. Trump is exploiting that and generating it to a large extent. Now, from a church-state point of view, obviously, it's even worse. It's bad enough to say that we don't like Japanese or we don't like Chinese or we don't like Eastern European Jews or some ethnic group. It's even worse when you start saying we want to exclude Muslims or Christians or on a religious basis. It goes directly against the First Amendment. And, by the way, in one respect, there's a provision in the Constitution that says there shall not be a religious test for office. Now, that's for office, but the spirit is obviously you shouldn't have a religious test for anything. And to say on immigration that we're going to exclude Muslims is flatly unconstitutional. You cannot discriminate on the basis of religion. So now Trump is saying, well, we'll exclude people from Muslim-dominated areas. And constitutionally, he might get away with that. But it's wrong. It's completely wrong. And the United States always recovers from these. We do a lot of damage, we hurt a lot of people, but eventually we usually apologize, about 30 years later.
if the Democratic candidates win the presidency and the vice presidency, and you have an opportunity to talk with President-elect Clinton at that point, what counsel would you give her about religious freedom and church-state separation and where we are on that?
Well, let me come back first to this religious exclusion and okay. the immigration. Okay. What counsel I would give her depends on whether who controls Congress. I mean, if the Democrats control Congress, which might happen even in the House, depending on if she wins big, then you pass an intelligent, comprehensive immigration reform along the lines of what the Senate passed 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have a limit on immigration, obviously, but you have due process protections. You have criteria for preference or treatment. You try to secure the borders, which we've been doing very effectively. Mm-hmm. What people don't realize, you know, Trump keeps talking, yelling about the immigration from Mexico, the illegal immigration from Mexico. Right now, for the last 2 years, there's been a net outflow. There are more people going from the United States to Mexico than from Mexico to the United States. He's talking about a past tense problem, in effect. You gradually legalize the people who are here. You have a pathway to citizenship. I mean, we know to do what to do. If there's a Republican Congress, you'll have a standoff. I mean, I don't know. In terms of separation of church and state, you have to reinvigorate separation. There have been a number of measures which I think invade that, which my counsel would be to quietly reverse course on. You can't, I mean, the basic thing is people have to have religious freedom, but government can't support religion, mm-hmm. period. And that's your basic two principles. There's a distortion of religious freedom that the Republicans, conservatives generally are pushing. And this is key. As a result of some of the Supreme Court decisions on gay rights and marriage equality, people with a strongly held religious belief should have the religious freedom not to do various things, or basically to discriminate against gay people. Well, that's wrong. You always have to look at religious freedom like any other freedom. Number one, it's not absolute. But number two, it's a freedom until you're affecting somebody else. I have an absolute freedom to wave my hand in the air, but that freedom stops in front of your nose.
Right.
I can't hit you in the nose. That's not a freedom. That's an invasion of your freedom, of your rights. And the same thing goes for religious freedom. Religious freedom is a shield, not a sword. It's one thing to say you have the freedom to practice your religion, and you ought to. It's another thing to say that you can use your religion to deprive a third party, someone else, of rights. And that's not right. Now, in some instances, we make accommodations for that in the Civil Rights Act and certain things for small businesses. But as a basic rule, you do not have the freedom to say, I won't serve black people in my restaurant because my religion says black people shouldn't eat in white restaurants. Nor do you have the religious freedom to say, I won't serve gay people in my restaurant because my religious belief says we shouldn't serve gay people. Nor do you have the religious freedom to say, as an employer, my employees shouldn't have access to abortion services or to a contraception because my religion objects to that. If your religion objects to it, don't do it, but not for them.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. Rabbi Pesner, thank you for talking with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's an absolute honor to have the conversation with someone as great as you.
Oh, listen, you're kind. The Jewish people generally, but the RAC where you are specifically, have always cared immensely about religious freedom and church-state separation. Mm-hmm. You know that we're hearing a lot of what is not really mm-hmm. religious freedom talked about in that way. Give me your sense of the status of religious mm-hmm. freedom right now.
Sure. So a little bit of historical context. In 1993, we helped author the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. My predecessor and my beloved colleague, Rabbi David Saperstein, quite a hero in the religious liberty arena, at least the authentic religious liberty arena, working together across partisan lines. It was a bipartisan effort. It was an interfaith effort. Passed what's affectionately known as RFRA, to protect religious minorities. That is to say, in the case of a Jewish person, that a Jew could not be discriminated against for wearing a yarmulke in the workplace. These were the kinds of concerns that we had. And for two decades, there was broad consensus that this really was an important protection of religious minorities. Well, some in the community, some people in the faith community, and some outside the faith community have decided to use what was intended to be a shield to protect people as a sword to actually damage people and harm them. And the best example, of course, is those who don't honor the equality of LGBT relationships, who would discriminate against LGBT folk in the workplace or their freedom to marry, who would claim that it would violate their religious freedom if they had to, for example, you know, provide, you know, flowers at a wedding or act as a photographer. The current state of things is that this is really playing out on a state level, because the federal RFRA doesn't actually apply in the states. And so individual states have taken upon themselves, and some have passed excellent RFRAs that really reflect the federal protective statute. But North Carolina, classic, Indiana, some states in the last 2 years have passed hateful, mean-spirited RFRAs that are really discriminatory acts against the LGBT community.
And because of that, some people are looking at religious freedom as no longer important, because it looks more like, as you said, a tool for attack. How do we regain the integrity of the language?
Yeah, really important. First of all, that people who are disposed towards social justice and progressive values need to talk about religious freedom and take back that language. We can't have religious liberty somehow become a kind of conservative talking point. It shouldn't be conservative or progressive. It really is about religious minorities, whether it's Muslims, Christians, or Jews, or any person of faith or a person of no faith, being able to practice with the free exercise. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Constitution provides for. And let's remember, the first right that's guaranteed is the religious right, the right to exercise freely one's religion. So we need to just defend that.
I know this afternoon you were in conferences talking about Jewish issues. What are Jewish issues?
Well, you know, you would think immediately, often people, when they talk to the organized Jewish community, that we're most concerned with Israel or Jewish defense. We are, of course, and the Religious Action Center and the Reform Jewish Movement are a Zionist organization that care about Israel and care about peace and justice with Palestine, or the Palestinian state, hopefully someday, two-state solution. But we're working, our top priority right now legislatively is around criminal justice reform and the Voting Rights Restoration Act. Many people may not realize that the original Civil Rights Act of 1964 was written in the conference room of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism. It was a Jewish organization that hosted the leadership conference for civil rights. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was drafted in our conference room. Dr. King, when he would come to Washington with his colleagues, would meet in our offices and would draft these famous pieces of legislation. In 2012, terrible court case Shelby eviscerated the Voting Rights Act. After decades, by the way, of reauthorization by Congress, by bipartisan majorities. And civil rights legislation in our country has always been about bipartisan majorities and had been reauthorized, by the way, by Republican and Democratic presidents. Suddenly in 2012, the Voting Rights Act became a partisan issue. We're working very hard on restoring the Voting Rights Act. And because of our historic role in the civil rights movement and the incredible, painful moment in American history on racial justice, what we see in Ferguson, Baltimore, Cleveland, New York, and across our United States, to reach across lines of difference, to work with the civil rights community, with the African-American church community, to reach with the interreligious community, to fight for racial justice for all people.
One last question. Regardless of who wins the White House, if you could have a quiet conversation with the new occupants of the White House, what would you say to them?
First, I would invite them to pray, and I would invite them into the thousands of year prophetic tradition of the Jewish people, having been slaves in Egypt, that were commanded to see ourselves as if we ourselves came out of Egypt, and then demanded by the prophets to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with God, because we are about seeing any human being who suffers, who is oppressed, as our own oppression or suffering. And so whether there's a Republican or a Democrat, whoever is in the White House, to take that sacred institution and to leverage it for justice for all people.
A really great answer from a great organization.
Thank you. It's okay. A blessing.
Tell me your name.
My name is Kate Kite. I'm the Political Operations Associate at LPAC.
Okay, and tell me about your dress.
So I am dressed as Wonder Queer, LPAC's official superhero of the convention. Our theme for 2016 is that it's time for all of us to be out and proud about who we are, but also what that brings to the political table, right? That we as queer women have unique voices with unique needs that are not always met just in the women's rights space and just in the LGBT space. So we're there to build community and give queer women a space to organize and talk about what those needs are and how we're going to fight for them.
If this convention goes like you want it to, what one thing has to be done?
You know, I'm really excited to hear Sarah McBride speak, first transgender person to ever speak at a convention, and to speak on the same night as Hillary Clinton. We were the first LGBT organization to endorse Hillary Clinton nationally. So for those two things to happen on one night will just be such a statement of that we're not just fighting for gay rights and stopping at marriage, that the Democratic Party, that Hillary Clinton recognizes this fight is ongoing and it's complex and it's intersectional.
Our organization has been very supportive of this whole movement because we have such strong beliefs about religious freedom and people. What's your thoughts about religious freedom?
I think that the faith community and the LGBT community are natural allies because the one thing we have in common is believing in love, right? Whether that's love of each other, love of a higher power, and love of community. And I think that there are the factions that use faith and religion as an excuse to build power on different sides, and maybe where I am and folks here are, that's not about love, and that's not something that I've ever felt was true to any religion. So I think it's wonderful to have faith partners in what we do, and it makes us stronger.
What do our listeners need to know from you that I may not know?
I think that there is a need for women, particularly young women, particularly young queer women, to get engaged politically. I think that there's a lot of talk about millennials and a lot of talk about how to reach single women, but I think that there is a large group of young queer folks that are, you know, this generation is going to be the most diverse in terms of race and also in terms of sexuality. And I think that building the community and taking up space as queer women and saying we do still want our own bars, we want our own coffee shops, we want our own political action committees, I think that's okay to demand, and we're here to build that community.
You're as good at talking about it as you are dressing
for it. Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
During our time at the Democratic National Convention, we heard from lawmakers, activists, and faith leaders. Let's listen to Rabbi Jack Moline in conversation with Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, as well as with a suffragette.
This is Jack Moline. I am standing in for Welton with Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California, who is a member of the Democratic Platform Drafting Committee. So, give me your impressions of the convention so far.
It's a convention that reminds me of the first convention I attended in 1972 in Florida when I was a delegate for Shirley Chisholm. She was the first African-American and the first woman to run for president. The excitement, the enthusiasm, you know, and quite a bit of debate and discussion about the issues. And it's good that Bernie Sanders did the wonderful job he has done because many of his delegates are here and helped create and shape a platform that's a progressive platform that everyone can embrace. And, of course, Hillary Clinton, her delegates and her alternates are phenomenal. The excitement about the first woman cracking this glass ceiling is just really overwhelming.
It's great.
So it's really great.
So the issues that we deal with primarily are religious freedom issues. What is the role that religion should be playing in our political process?
Well, first, I believe very clearly and firmly in the separation of church and state, barring none. People of faith, however, have a value system that speaks to the best in human nature, social justice, economic justice, peace. People of faith understand that we're all a part of God's family. And so I think it's those values that drive our support or opposition to public policies. But we should never, ever allow the church to dictate what the state does, nor should we allow the state to dictate what the church does.
Great. Last question. You get 1 minute alone with Donald Trump. What do you say to him?
Stop being such a mean person.
There you go. Thank you for your good work, and thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
This is Jack Moline, and I'm on the subway with...
Patricia Doss.
And, Patricia, you're dressed as a suffragette.
A suffragist, yes.
Yes, and a suffragist. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Which is the less demeaning way to term it.
It's the more American way.
The more American way.
The suffragette was British. The British women adopted that as a... Yeah, okay.
So, women have the vote.
Yes.
So why are you dressed as a suffragist?
To commemorate the history of the event. It's been 96 years since women won the right to vote. It took us 96 years to get to the next step, basically. And I just want everyone to remember that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and all those women who... were beaten, force-fed, jailed, so that we could have the right to vote.
And what is the message for other disenfranchised groups in America right now?
That when you organize and you stick together, you can get things done.
So our program deals primarily with the intersection of faith and freedom.
Okay.
What's the role of the faith community in achieving the goals that you've just articulated?
Yeah, I can only speak for my own faith. And so when you get discouraged, you maybe go inward and get some strength from whatever spiritual source you value, because sometimes you just don't feel like you're strong enough on your own, and you just need to feel like there's a higher good that you're working for.
Well, thanks for talking with us, and thanks for being here.
All right. Thank you.
Oh, and Welton Gaddy got a question in with Jerry Springer.
You know, I get my values from my religious experience, but other people have a different religion or a different view. They do it their way.
But there's a difference in institutionalized religion.
Oh, sure.
And personal religion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This has to be a place where it doesn't matter what your religion is, or it doesn't matter even if you have religion. This country is free.
During our week-long coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, we heard from legislators, activists, and faith leaders from across the country. We'll wrap up our coverage with words from Arab American Institute President Jim Zogby, Representative Brad Sherman, Democrat of California, Delegate Judith Foster, and Rabbi Shmuley Botech.
Our good friend Jim Zogby joins us for a few minutes. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Talk about what this convention, what this party needs to be doing in relation to the Middle East that would be more satisfying for you.
Well, it wouldn't be satisfying for me. It's a question of what needs to be done.
Right.
And what needs to be done is to unwind the crisis that we're currently in, which is one of two pathologies. The one pathology is Israel, which is has a sense of entitlement and therefore feels that it can do no wrong and will never be abused, will never be criticized for what it does. The other pathology is on the Palestinian side, and that is the abused child that feels there's nothing they can do to ever make it right, and so they'll act out, or they'll do nothing. The result is that you have this downward spiral with Israel building more settlements, being more repressive, taking more measures against Palestinians, and Palestinians responding sometimes violently and sometimes in horrific ways.
Yeah.
What needs to happen is an adult needs to enter into the mix and say to the spoiled child, stop, and to the abused child, I'm going to pay attention to you for the first time and consider your needs. That doesn't seem to be happening, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. And so I'm afraid that we're not going to be ending this this conflict, you know, in the next several years. It's disastrous for the Israeli people, disastrous for the Palestinian people, and it's disastrous for America. It makes us look very bad in the eyes of the world.
Have we made any progress over the last 4 to 8 years?
Yes. Obama has still a higher favorable rating than George Bush ever had. But the people in the Arab world do not trust America, do not trust American leadership, and do not believe that we consider their needs in making our decisions. Mm-hmm. They feel that we're hopelessly biased. And frankly, I can't argue with them about that. Now, here in America, on Middle East issues, there's really been a shift, and a partisan shift. Democrats are far more thoughtful, far more progressive than Republicans, who have been held captive by the religious right. Mm-hmm. And Democrats, I think, have a much more open view and a more balanced view of Israel, Palestine, and what America ought to be doing.
Regardless of which party wins the presidency, if you had a chance to talk about what you want to talk about with the new administration, what would be the essence of what you would say?
Pretty much what I've been saying for the last 40 years. End the occupation, give Palestinians freedom, and let Israelis know that they will be secure when Palestinians get justice. That's it.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Congressman, when you use Trump's name in connection with the presidency of the United States, what thoughts go through your mind?
That I'm in a room here with people that hate Trump so much that they may not be able to appeal to that swing group of people who are considering Trump or Hillary. Mm-hmm. If every time Trump says something, we feel that we have to say the polar opposite, we're giving in to him. Mm-hmm. For example, he's against TPP. So what, we're supposed to be for it? No. Likewise, he doesn't want to admit any refugee from Syria. So we want to admit all of them without vetting. The way we cannot become his caricature of us. We are for a reasonable immigration policy, a reasonable refugee policy.
Yes.
And we are not for bad trade deals.
Yes.
And if we decide every time he says something we have to be the opposite, we lose.
Let me ask you, today, and both in the news and in the arena itself, there's been a lot of emphasis on the Black Lives Matter, that statement, that group. Give me your thoughts about that, please.
Well, we've got to get a situation where every member of every police force is treating everyone with respect. At the same time, we've got to honor those 800,000 almost universally selfless individuals. And I'll have to give it to Giuliani. He's right. When you call 911, they don't ask you whether you're black or white. They just come to save you. So we have to honor our police officers, but we are already on record on that for 100 years.
Yes. Yes.
And so what's new and needs to be fleshed out is we also need to make sure that everyone's treated with respect and that police officers get the training they need to be able to deal with tough situations. So we have to respect police officers. We have to insist that all of our citizens are treated with respect. Again, we cannot be the polar opposite of Trump and let him define us. He's the law and order candidate, according to him. That doesn't mean we're the anti-law and order candidate. He loves and respects our first responders. That doesn't mean we don't. That means we do, too. And we did before he did. There is a tendency to think that those who are seriously considering voting for Trump are either racists or idiots. That's not true.
Right.
Thank you.
Congressman, thank you so much. Have
thank
a great convention. I want you to meet Judith Foster from Boston Praise Radio. One thing that you're saying that I don't hear around this convention hall much is that Hillary Clinton really could be in trouble.
Yes.
Related to the election.
Yes.
Well, tell me why.
Before coming here, I was part of Jill Stein's Green Party for a number of years. I'm no longer. I'm a registered independent, but I switched to Democrat so I can vote for Bernie. But I think that from what all I've heard from especially the young people is that she's not listening to them. and she's not taking them seriously. And there's also a concern that she's not respecting the wishes of the voters.
And in each of those instances, what's the point? What's the contradiction?
The contradiction is that they are saying that they're with Bernie and that they want to bring Bernie supporters into the fold.
I see.
But they're not making a concerted effort. And from what I've been told, they need to show good faith that Bernie is worthy, mm-hmm. and that he was robbed the election. Those are their words. And I was told by one person that they are supported by thousands who will not vote for Hillary, no matter what. And some of them are even delegates and don't want to use their names because of the ramifications.
So what if you had the chance to have 2 minutes with Hillary Clinton? What would you say to her?
I would say to Hillary, call Bernie, get Bernie and Jill Stein in a meeting, find out what your common grounds are, compromise on those, and bring those two people into the fold, or this election will not be yours.
Judith Foster, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me on State of Belief Radio. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself and tell our audience some of the reasons that I'm wanting to talk with you and that they should know what you're doing.
My name is Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. Why should they want to listen to me? Because I am a Jew in a Jewish museum, kind of like a Jewish guy in his native environment.
And you also, since we're here for the DNC, could tell them something about your political campaign.
Well, I am here for the DNC, and last week I was in Cleveland for the RNC. I love the political conventions because they're a celebration of democracy. I think we take it for granted that we can get up and advocate for candidates, express our opinions, and no one's like locking us up, and we don't have to be afraid that any second we're going to be censored or imprisoned. So, you know, whereas many people see the political process this year as nothing but a circus, and it is very entertaining, I see in it just all of the intricacies of a people that are free, a nation that is free, and expressing its freedom. So I love the political conventions.
Tell me how you walk the tightrope between religion and politics getting entangled and religion playing its proper role and government playing its role in the nation. How do you walk that line?
Well, I actually think that it's very straightforward. It's very simple, simpler than we might think. There's a separation between church and state in the United States, which is great. America has one God, but it has no religion. There's no religion that's imposed. So what religion must seek to do, therefore, is influence the political dialogue through values as opposed to a particular faith. The fact is that Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, we really share common values. We all believe in the infinite, the spark of the divine that is in every mm-hmm. human being. We believe in the equality of mankind. Those are religious ideas. Mm-hmm. They're not ideas that we extract from, say, evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. They're ideas that we extract from theology. But they permeate the body politic. Everyone believes it, which is mm-hmm. why we believe that we should all be respecting each other. There are many other important religious beliefs. Take the idea of human dignity, the fact that there's a specific dignity that we should not be compromising. And why we should respect each other, and why mm-hmm. there should be political dialogue as opposed to wars and battles in the streets. Right. Why every opinion matters. Why everyone deserves a vote. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, democracy seems to be a crazy form of political government. Mm-hmm. The Nobel Prize-winning economist gets only one vote, along with a guy that doesn't even know how to spell economics. Yeah. Yes, they get the same vote because they each have equal human dignity. They are of equal infinite worth. So that's why religion can influence the political debate without it being religious. It's about mm-hmm. values.
Yeah. One last question. If you had an opportunity to talk privately with Donald Trump, what one thing would you want him to hear from you?
I'd want him to hear that that apologies are something that come from strength and not weakness. I don't demonize Trump. I think that demonizing each other on both sides of the aisle is mm-hmm. a mistake. Trump appeals to a lot of Americans because of his candor. Mm-hmm. He appeals to a lot of Americans because they think that beltway politics is utterly broken. But when Trump has said or done things that the public has found offensive, it's no big deal to simply come along and say, look, I didn't mean to offend. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if people feel a sense of woundedness, and let's move on. But that's also true, I think, of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. I think that both candidates are finding it difficult to take responsibility and say sorry in this election cycle. The fact is that we in the Jewish religion, our holiest day of the year is Yom Kippur. It's not a day that we blow the shofar, the ram's horn. It's not a day that we eat the unleavened cakes of the matzah. It's rather a day that we simply come before God, acknowledge our fallibility, our humanity. We offer an apology to God, and we say, give us another year so we can move on. I don't see why we can't translate that into politics. So I would ask both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump that when you make mistakes in the political process, you know, say you're sorry and move on. Look, the DNC started with a scandal this week, mm-hmm. and it started with a scandal with a Jewish congresswoman who was the most powerful female Jewish congresswoman maybe in American history, Debbie mm-hmm. Wasserman Schultz, who was forced to resign her position as the chairwoman of the DNC. And why? Because she was supposed to be neutral and she favored a candidate, Hillary Clinton, ironically against Bernie Sanders, who's Jewish. Not that anyone cares about the ethnicities here. I guess she just felt that Hillary was the front runner. Be that as it may, she should have just gotten up and said, I made a mistake. I'm very sorry. Mm-hmm. Both campaigns, both parties seem to be unwilling and incapable of apologizing to the American people. Now, what is the principal contribution that the Jewish people have made, as opposed to our Christian brothers and sisters, to political dialogue, to world events? It's the fact that we don't have a Jesus figure in our religion. We don't mm-hmm. have that God-man who's mm-hmm. infallible. We have Moses who makes mistakes. Abraham makes mistakes. All of our great biblical figures are human beings doing their best to lead godly lives. And they are biblical figures specifically because of the struggle they have to do better. I don't want American politicians pretending to be perfect. So if Trump is imperfect, some people would say highly imperfect, let him acknowledge that. Let him accept responsibility when he makes an error and move on. The same thing would have been true with Hillary Clinton and her email scandal a long time ago. Had she come forward and said it was a big mistake, shouldn't have done it. Let me take responsibility and move on. The problem is that today everyone thinks that an apology is an admission of guilt, and that's why they shy away from it. But the American public expects, above all else, from our public officials, accountability.
Rabbi, thank you so much. Thank you. I hope you have a great convention.
Thank you.
Our convention coverage was made possible only through the tireless participation of Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. We are very grateful to Greg LaBelle, assistant professor of political management at George Washington University, who was so generous with his time and insights as events unfolded in both Cleveland and Philadelphia. And a special thanks to Jamoni Moore, who made our video coverage of the Democratic National Convention possible. Welton Gaddy has the week off, but in early August of 2008, he sat down with the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, who at the time was director of the religion department at the Chautauqua Institution. It's valuable to remember what the key issues were at this time 8 years ago.
Reverend Joan Brown Campbell previously served as the executive director of the U.S. Office of the World Council of Churches and as the general secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA. She has worked closely with many religious, civil rights, and political leaders. On her Rolodex and in her friendship list are people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Martin Luther King Jr. and President Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela, and on it goes. She is a tireless advocate for democracy, and she works out of a strong base of faith. What are, in your mind, the key religious issues in this campaign?
Surely the war is one. One of the main religious issues is really how people feel about issues of war and peace. Not only whether we should have gone to war, but whether or how we should leave Iraq, if that becomes the question. Even though the pundits say, well, maybe that's not so strong now of an issue, I think it's still very strong. But I think there's another underneath issue that doesn't get, we get the issues of abortion, gay marriage, those kind of issues are always surfaced. But I think there's an underneath issue that we don't talk about, but I think it's a deeply religious issue. That's really the issue of the economy. Mm. Because who's affected by an economy that goes bad?
Why aren't we talking about it?
I think people are afraid of it, in one sense. It's deeply personal. It's deeply private to some people. The fact that Cleveland, where I come from, more people are having their houses taken away from them, more mortgages have failed than in almost any other city. And believe me, in the city, They're talking about those issues. They don't seem to surface as much at the national level, but I would imagine if the candidates go into town after town in this country, they're going to get asked questions, no matter whether it's named the economy. They really are questions of how are people doing in their personal lives, in their ability to educate their children. All of these things are huge for Americans, I think. People call them economic issues. They're profoundly issues of faith. Who has resources and who doesn't? Every single time, as you well know, we have an economic downturn, it's inevitably the poor that become poorer. Often it affects women more than it does others. It certainly affects young people, and it affects people new into the job market. Jobs are hard to come by, and I think those are deeply issues of faith. Every pastor will tell you that in their congregation, they have people that have lost their homes. Divorces have resulted from that. They have people that used to have enough money, certainly to get by, if not a little more, and that's not true anymore. People are turning out for church suppers more than they used to, not because the food's so great, but because there's plenty of food.
This discussion about faith in public life is by no means a new one. It's been a part of the debate in this country since the beginning of our country, I guess. Meacham, John Meacham of Newsweek and the Washington Post's On Faith column pointed out that failing to consider the past commits us to the tyranny of the present. Now, for you, Joan, what are some of the most important lessons from that past?
Well, I think one of the things that is one of the most important lessons is the vital role that religious liberty has always played in this nation's history. I was fascinated, Welton, that Christians, Muslims, and Jews alike across the board, whether they were conservative or liberal or whatever tag you put on people, the one point of agreement really was that religious liberty matters.
I just saw this study that indicated that in the campaign so far, the candidates have spent almost as much time talking about religion as they have about foreign policy, and that bothers me.
Yeah, me too. I think that's a very disturbing thing to know.
I'm wondering, what do you think, what do you fear most about religion's role in this election?
Well, what I fear is exactly what you just stated, and that is it plays an exaggerated role. All of a sudden, it seems to make a huge amount of difference to Americans as to what religious group someone belongs to. The fact of the matter is, it's been said over and over again, that religion is someone's personal and private matter, and that we really oughtn't to judge people on what denomination do they belong to, what history do they have, what values they have is huge. And religious people, just like everybody else, ought to be asking the questions, separate and apart from their religious history. Frankly, whether someone is a born-again Christian or not should not be a part of our debate and our dialogue. Whether someone is a conservative Jew or a liberal Jew, or whether these are the things that worry me, instead of getting down to the questions of why do we have hungry people and what do you, the candidate, what do you think you should do about that? What's going to happen to the issues in the Middle East? How are you going to be a peacemaker? Those are religious questions, but they're not framed in that way.
Joan, can you point to one moment that really made you stop and think? Maybe you were surprised, or maybe it raised a new question for you about faith in public life. Was there such a moment?
I think it really was this morning, Welton, when young Eboo Patel spoke. And here's a 32-year-old young man, began a youth corps, is beginning to teach people how to do interfaith work. Not assume that they know how, not have a focus group, not have everybody over for dinner and think they're all going to get along, but teach them how to do it. And part of what he's teaching them is that we need to be able to find our common voice if we're going to address public life. It's remarkable what he's been able to do with young people. And I guess the reason it was so important to me was, I think what he really was a harbinger of hope. When he talked about why he thinks young people are so invested in this particular election. And he talked about the way Obama and the way he speaks to people has a particular resonance with young people. And that was a surprising comment, that the way in which he really delved into that in terms of why did those words particularly make a difference for young people. And I asked him a tough question. I said, well, what happens if somebody else wins? And he said, well, he thinks young people are invested in the nation at this point. And maybe it's been the war, maybe it's been what they've seen, and maybe it's a reaction against a generation that maybe wasn't as concerned. And those were surprising insights for me.
If you could take what we have shared and learned here at Chautauqua this week, and you could share it with the two candidates, what would you say to John McCain and Barack Obama?
Well, I think I would say to both of them that they don't need to wear their faith on the sleeve, but that what they do need to know is that faith does matter. Take the faith community seriously, but take seriously the diversity of the faith community. That, I think, is the most important thing they need to hear. It's not a community of like-minded people. And there's no way they can say, I'm only going to go to the evangelicals, their vote matters, or I'm only going to go to the black community, or I'm only going to go to the liberal community. They need to speak to the diversity of the religious community. It's pretty powerful in this country.
Has this week changed Joan Brown Campbell in any way?
You know, I'm by now a grandmother of eight people, and they are people. Five of them are voters. It re-energizes me. I love seeing the audience reaction to this and the nitty-gritty back and forth. It's probably, of all the weeks at Chautauqua so far, this has had more interaction between people of different viewpoints. So I'm by nature an optimist and somebody who wants to keep going at this business. And I suppose it makes me feel re-energized for this work. You can get discouraged in this interfaith work. And sometimes the progress is minimal. And you see a week like this and you realize we have made progress. I think that was Eboo's great gift. Here's this young man willing to take this on, and he's got a lifetime to give to us.
Joan Brown Campbell is director of the Religion Department of the Chautauqua Institute in New York. She's formerly the General Secretary of the National Council of the Churches. She is my good friend and a friend to this nation. Joan, thank you.
Thank you, Will.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archives, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that's grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what?